The following podcast is a replay of a webinar that took place on November 9th of last year titled Artificial Intelligence in the Medical Industry, Emerging Issues and Best Practices, presented by Covington. It is one of two webinars Medical Alley has recently hosted on the increasingly popular topic of AI in healthcare. If you'd like to watch the video replay of this webinar, you can find it on the Medical Alley YouTube page. Please enjoy this webinar replay featuring Andrew Ment, Pam Forrest, and Adrian Perry of Covington. The Medical Alley podcast is brought to you by MentorMate. MentorMate empowers healthcare clients to deliver on their mission and transform the human experience through technology. For over 20 years, clients have trusted MentorMate to guide their vision, design innovative products, and build secure solutions while understanding the specific nuances of their industry. MentorMate's global team in the U.S., Eastern Europe, and Latin America helps clients in all sectors of healthcare transform their organizations, from Fortune 500 pharmaceutical companies and commercial payers to hospital systems, medical device manufacturers, and beyond. Learn more at MentorMate.com/healthcare.
And we are excited to get started with today's webinar. My name is Ben Wagner with Medical Alley, and today's presentation is titled Artificial Intelligence in the Medical Devices Industry. You can see it there on your screen, Emerging Issues and Best Practices. We have three speakers with us today from Covington to discuss some key considerations in this AI-enabled medical device space and to share some best practices and also to answer any questions. Afterward, we are going to have a Q&A portion. So if you do have a question for any of our speakers here today, put it in the chat and we'll do our best to answer all of the questions that you may have. Want to remind everybody that we are recording this. So if you want to watch this back later, there will be an option to do that. With that, let's get started with our great panel of experts here today. Andrew Ment, Pam Forrest, and Adrian Perry with Covington. First off, thank you to the three of you for being here today. Really looking forward to this discussion. With that, let's send it over to the Covington team here for those introductions and to begin this discussion.
Thanks very much, Ben. So I'll start. I'm Andrew Ment. I'm a partner in Covington's corporate practice based in New York, and I focus on mergers, acquisitions, and other investment transactions in the medical device and life sciences industry. And I'll pass it over to Pam.
Good morning. I'm Pam Forrest. I'm a partner in Covington's FDA practice. I co-chair our medical device practice, and I focus on advising device manufacturers on sort of the full life cycle of FDA medical device requirements. Includes a lot of work with software as a medical device and increasingly AI-enabled medical devices.
Hi, everyone. My name is Adrian Perry. I'm a partner in Covington's New York office. I'm part of our tech and IP transactions group, so I focus on commercial arrangements involving tech, IP, and data of all types. I've been focused on AI and now generative AI deals in particular, so I'll bring some of that experience to bear. Looking forward to being here with you all and having a good discussion.
So thanks. So we're going to start off today with just some basics about AI, what is it? And then we'll lead into a section on FDA regulatory matters. And then Adrian and I will come back and we'll talk about some commercial and transactional considerations. So first, what is AI? Well, at the most basic, it's the capability of software to imitate intelligent human behavior and does that by being trained and essentially recognizing patterns. I think it's very important as we have this conversation to recognize that there are some unique considerations and certainly a unique context in which AI and AI enabled devices, you know, are existing and are going to be considered. But there's the whole panoply of considerations that we've all always lived with standard medical devices that are still going to be relevant in certain cases. Pretty much everything on this slide here, you know, aside from AI ethics and governance, has arisen in different contexts in the medical device space. So I would say it's kind of like the same challenge plus. some terminology that's relevant as we'll go through our presentation here, right? So AI at kind of the top is the largest bucket. And then we'll talk about things like machine learning, deep learning, generative AI, which is kind of where it starts getting really interesting. And that's sort of term papers and things like that. The foundation models, which is an important element of understanding that there's both the input, the output, and then how is that processed? And then sort of large language models, which is kind of like the biggest thing going on. There's an emerging set of principles that some of which are present in regulation, some of which are being talked about and thought of as matters for proposed regulation. But I would say that there's kind of an industry moving towards saying, what do we do with, how do we manage this new technology in a way that it is, you know, safe, effective, all the same traditional concepts we want for things that are in medical, but also in this context where there are so many other sort of issues and risks. And so things like fairness and bias, very important, because when you train an AI device, the inputs, if the inputs incorporate bias, the outputs are likely to incorporate bias. So that's a very important thing to look at. We'll talk a little bit more about these as we go on. So this is really just kind of like a place setter introduction slide, but things like understanding how you can ensure that you understand what the AI is doing and validate that the outputs are reasonable. Like, that's an important step to take, and the ability to audit and review what is the model doing, what are the inputs, and are the outputs reliable. Very important concepts. In terms of policy development, there's a lot of it going on. There are a number of important principles that are being articulated. Last week, the White House issued an executive order that sort of very broad ranging, sort of forward looking in terms of directing essentially a task force to develop a number of AI principles that are sector agnostic. And so, like, probably one of the highest profile things we hear about now are like with the entertainment industry and generative AI in terms of content, but many of those principles are also going to be very relevant to the healthcare sector and to medical devices. And then there are sort of very much healthcare sector specific initiatives. And so this, on the right, we see some of those. And then just because it's sort of hot off the press, just sort of some of the key points that are raised in the White House executive order, for instance, really trying to, the number of these are going to read on healthcare industry to make sure that there are policies and frameworks to try to, avoid bias, to have, safety for personal information, very critical issue with any kind of data incorporating or using devices, but in particular AI, programs to establish safety, security, reliability testing, and then really sort of looking to try to build a framework for these technologies going forward. So now that's sort of kind of what's going on, big picture. And I think now we'd like to dial this in and go to the FDA. So Pam, I'll turn this over to you.
Hey, thanks, Andrew. I think I'll state the obvious, which is that AI is increasingly important and prevalent in medical devices. We're seeing AI-enabled devices across a number of medical settings, quite a bit in radiology, but increasingly in cardiovascular, ophthalmic, neurology, and beyond. One of the areas which I'm sure the audience is familiar with as being sort of AI-intensive is our clinical decision support software tools. I've listed an example there to identify and track patients with suspicious lung nodules, but it seems nearly every day I get a call from another company or entrepreneur with a clinical decision support technology that AI enabled to identify, track, spot, monitor, et cetera. Another example, optical camera-based measurements of pulse, heart, breathing, and a respiratory rate. But this is just a tiny set of AI-enabled devices. And as new as AI feels, FDA has been clearing and approving AI-enabled devices for many years, and actually has a website which lists dozens of AI-enabled medical devices that have been brought to market. So we're in a really important time with a lot of focus on AI and medical devices, but we have been in a longer period of time where the technology has been developing and FDA has been reacting. And this is an eyeful, but I wanted to put this up here, which is really a timeline of FDA's approach to regulating software, which I think is the place that we need to start, and then zoom into FDA's specific focus on AI. I'm not going to step through every box on this timeline. That would take us the full hour. But I think there's a couple of high-level points that I do want to impart. First, FDA as a regulator has, I think, been a real thought leader in our global regulatory community on the issues of regulation of software in general, and specifically AI. What we've seen really over the last 10 years is the rollout of multiple guidance documents that have articulated policies on how FDA plans to treat different types of software functions, with a seminal point in 2016 with the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act, where FDA actually amended, where Congress amended the definition of medical device to exclude certain software functions. And part of that, which I would guess many in the audience are familiar with, is a lot of thinking and discussion around clinical decision support tools, some of which are within the definition of medical device and some which are not, and many which are AI enabled. So that's a really important intersection between sort of the overall framework on the approach to software and AI specifically. We'll now move to the next slide and kind of look more carefully at what FDA has been doing in the area of regulation of AI as a subset of the regulation of software. And you know, I think it's important to step back and think about what is special or different about AI as it interacts with medical devices. And I like to say that it's sort of the really exciting piece of AI is what poses the greatest challenge for FDA and other medical device regulators, because as we know, the FDA medical device regulatory framework is set up to handle a device that gets approved or cleared, which then maybe the manufacturer in 6 months or 12 months wants to modify and makes a decision on whether they need to go back to FDA and get a new clearance or approval. But of course, the beauty, the challenge, the excitement of AI is that it enables a device to be non-static, to be improving over time, to get better. And that presents, of course, a real challenge for our current regulatory framework. And this is what FDA began to really examine in earnest in 2019 with a discussion paper and a proposed regulatory framework addressing this issue of continuous change in medical devices. And the concept that was articulated at that point was the predetermined change control plan, the acronym being PCCP. And we've seen that over the last couple of years, FDA has taken further steps towards developing that. There was an action plan around AI and ML that FDA disseminated in 2021, where it further articulated a commitment to move forward with PCCP. And then we saw this year in 2023, a draft guidance on predetermined change control plans. And I will back up 1 year and say, importantly, in 2022, Congress passed amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, known as FDORA, which authorize the use of predetermined change control plans, PCCPs, not just in the AI-enabled setting, but across devices. So I think in a sense, we have sort of this important challenge posed by AI, which may have catalyzed a broader change in our medical device framework, which is nascent. We don't have really precedent yet as to how that will roll out, but I think it certainly has opened up a door for a different way to handle device modifications, which we hope will help to accommodate and encourage further innovation in the AI space. And then I think secondly, and we're going to talk more about PCCP and this next topic, FDA has been in collaboration with international regulators struggling to get its arms around how to manage those trustworthy AI concepts that Andrew teed up. How do we mitigate against bias? How do we ensure transparency? How do we avoid AI being sort of a black box, inscrutable to the healthcare practitioner? And so there have been some writings that are sort of an outcome of international collaboration that we'll talk about a little bit as well. So just to give a little bit more granularity on this PCCP concept, which I think will become increasingly important. And this is just an encapsulation of what FDA said in the draft guidance document. What does FDA want to see in a PCCP? And again, this is would be part of a pre-market submission, a 510K or a PMA. So this is where a manufacturer is trying to anticipate the types of changes that that its device will undergo and get, in a sense, pre-clearance or pre-approval from FDA for that set of changes. So what does FDA want to see? Based on the draft guidance document, clearly a description of the modifications and as much detail as possible. It's important that the modifications do not take the original device outside the intended use or indications for use that the device was initially cleared or approved for. And the manufacturer would need to address whether the changes will be implemented manually or automatically and globally or specific to sites or patients. FDA is also interested in understanding what the protocol will be for implementing those modifications. So, you know, one would need to specify the methodology to develop, validate, and implement the modifications to ensure that the device continues to deliver in a safe and effective manner for the initial and relevant patient population. And then FDA is interested in the impact assessment. You know, what are the risks and benefits of these predicted changes that will occur? And a successful PCCP would mean that as part of the clearance or approval process, FDA has, in a sense, signed off on a body of future modifications for the device. So we talked about PCCP, which I think has by far been the most important focus of FDA's sort of thinking around regulation of AI. But then, as I mentioned, there's also been a great deal of collaboration with international regulators around sort of how do we handle these large concepts that permeate not just AI in the medical device context, but beyond, things like transparency and usability and avoiding bias. And what we saw in 2021 is the FDA, in collaboration with Health Canada and the MHRA, issued what they've called good machine learning practices, or GMLP. So we have good manufacturing practices and good clinical practices. These are GMLP. These are not regulations. This is really kind of a think piece or principles guidance, where FDA and other regulators have sort of said what needs to be. So, you know, I think the ones I kind of focus on are number four here. Training and data sets are independent of test sets, a core concept in the development of an AI-enabled device. Clinical study participants and data sets are representative of the intended patient population. That's, of course, a call out to the avoidance of bias. So, you know, these are high-level concepts, have not been developed into regulation or the force of law. But I think if I put my crystal ball into place, I would say down the road, we may see that, because AI does pose these unique challenges for medical device and other technologies. And I think regulators will start to drill down even further. This is going back to PCCPs, and it's really right hot off the press, just like the executive order. These same international regulators have come together with some thoughts around the concept of PCCPs. So PCCP guiding principles document was issued just last month. And again, very high level, but the thinking here is that PCCPs need to be focused and bounded. And the thought there is bounded to the initial intended use of the device. So, so one shouldn't try to get preclearance or approval for devices that go beyond, changes that go beyond the intended use of the device. PCCPs should be based on risk, evidence-based, consistent with transparency, and consistent with a total life cycle perspective. So this slide is not specifically relevant to our medical device context, but I think just because we're talking about FDA thinking in general, it's important to note that FDA has also been doing some thinking around AI as it interacts on the drug and biologic side. The most of the action we've seen so far is what I've talked to you about already on the CDRH side, but we have recently seen a few discussion papers where FDA has solicited feedback on the use of AI and digital health technologies in drug development and commercialization. So just things to keep your eye on. FDA has said that these concepts have relevance in the medical device world. So I think this is a stay tuned. We're at the sort of the thinking and discussion stage right now on this side of the equation. And this is sort of just to let people know that going a little bit more adjacent, but still within our same overarching regulator, the Department of Health and Human Services, we wanted to just flag at a high level that there are other key entities that are looking to regulate in this space. So if you look at other components of the Department of Health and Human Services outside of FDA, for example, the Office of Civil Rights and the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology within HHS have issued proposed rules on discriminatory algorithms in healthcare settings and certified healthcare IT and predictive decision support interventions. So again, the clinical decision support issue and health IT, other regulators within the umbrella of HHS have also been noting concern around bias in particular and issuing regulations. I think if we zoom way out here from HHS, health AI has gained the attention at the congressional level as well. We saw in September, Senator Cassidy from the Senate Health Committee has sought public feedback on sort of the ways in which AI poses questions in healthcare settings and beyond. And Senator Cassidy noted that FDA's medical device framework may need to change in order to accommodate AI. And of course, we've seen that with Fedora and the authorization of predetermined change control plans. And he also noted that a one-size-fits-all approach to AI regulation is probably not the way to go, that it may stifle innovation. And I think we've seen FDA take a very targeted approach, looking, I think, thoughtfully at the specific challenges that AI-enabled medical devices posed and having kind of a targeted approach through both the PCCP workstream as well as the collaboration with international regulators on the bigger issues, which has, again, resulted in things like the Good Machine Learning Practices Think Piece document. This is sort of zooming into the state level, again, just an example of the really seems ubiquitous attention that regulators, particularly in the healthcare space, are raising concerns and questions around AI and the challenges that it poses for the delivering of healthcare. So what we saw is that in September of last year, California's Attorney General sent letters to 30 hospital CEOs requesting information about how healthcare facilities and other providers are identifying and addressing racial and ethnic disparities in software they use to help make decisions about patient care or hospital administration. So again, that clinical decision support piece, AI-enabled, concerns about transparency and bias. Again, all part of that introduction that Andrew made around our overarching issues that we struggle with in terms of assuring trustworthy AI. The letter requested information such as a list of all commercially available or purchased decision-making tools, the purpose that the tools are currently used for, and the names of the persons responsible for ensuring they do not have disparate impacts. So again, a lot of focus, a lot of attention around these key issues of bias, transparency, usability, and the like. And I think with that, we're ready to move back to Adrian and Andrew.
Great. Thanks a lot, Pam. So we're going to zoom out now and just talk about some broader AI, particularly generative AI issues that are coming up in the commercial and transactional context. And we'll start by talking about sort of the lifeblood of this entire ecosystem, which is data. The first thing I'll say is that data is almost a misnomer, because any type of content now can be processed and used in these tools. So be sure to keep that in mind when people are talking about training data. There's actually a move in the market to try and refer to it more as training content or training material, because you think data, you think facts and information, maybe it's not protectable by IP. Data usually isn't, but it really could be any type of content, right? Software code, which is copyrightable, images, song lyrics, you name it. I mean, everything can be analyzed, any sort of audiovisual component. So just that's the first thing, is to make sure you understand what, when we're saying data, what are we talking about? Then the next thing is understanding, well, where is this data or content where is it being sourced from to power these tools? And I would imagine there are folks in this audience that may be, customers of these tools, maybe engaging third-party providers to use these AI tools, or also could be in a situation where they're going to offer these tools in connection with a device, maybe through an app or something. So just keep in mind, depending on where you're positioned in this ecosystem, it might impact, how you react to certain of these issues. So we'll keep it, general and hopefully useful. So when you're thinking about the tools that the generative AI, presents, it's powered by data. You want to understand what these data sources are. Is it licensed in through agreements, or whether it's a negotiated agreement or an open source or commons license? Is there any information that qualifies as personal information? If so, you have the whole layer of privacy laws that may add restrictions on how that information can be used. A lot of information that powers AI is done through scraping. And that, raises different risks if it's not done within the bounds of the law. So it's important to understand whether you're launching your own tool or engaging a third party to use their tool, try and understand from them whether or not they understand where their data comes from, because you'd be surprised. Some folks are just kind of indiscriminately scraping information. They don't necessarily understand where the data is coming from, and that may lead to, risks down the line for everyone that's engaging with them. So when we're thinking about asking these questions around data, let's say you're in a position of, you're talking to a third party that provides generative AI services and trying to decide whether or not you're going to do a deal with them. First thing you want to find out is, do they have some system of cataloging their data that they're ingesting into their algorithm? We talked a little bit already about understanding the sources, whether there are, they're just getting licenses and getting data that way, if they're scraping or mining data. And if they are they doing so in obeying the license terms or terms of use of the websites? I mean, these are basic questions to ask. It doesn't have to necessarily require, weeks and weeks of diligence. Even in an hour phone call, you can discover a lot about the potential partner, whether or not they're taking, these issues seriously. So again, it's even just getting some basic information about whether or not the counterparty has a data management system, they're cataloging their data, they can tell you whether or not they're licensing or scraping or getting it through other means. If they're scraping, how they're managing risk on that front, that'll tell you a lot. So this digs in a little bit on sort of, okay, well, why are we asking these questions about, the data sources and how data is managed? Well, again, I referenced this on a couple of slides ago. There's privacy issues. If information, personal information, is being used as part of these tools, that could introduce some risk if it's not being used in accordance with the law. Of course, there could be contract issues that come up if it comes to pass that the party you're working with is using a bunch of data pursuant to agreements, but they're not abiding by those agreements. There could be rights, for instance, that maybe a counterparty has in the data that they've allowed a AI tool provider to use, that could impact the rights that you have in the results and in the outputs, or in what can be done with the information that you provide. Because the way these products work is you have to provide inputs, prompts into whatever the tool is to then generate an output. And of course, you know, you've heard us mention unfairness and bias. You'll hear it again throughout the rest of this talk, because it's a big risk here, and it's definitely getting the attention of regulators on, you know, from different sides, including the FTC. So again, understanding the sources of data and how the data is used and cataloged is important, because you want to avoid these risks, whether you are the one providing a tool or a service, or you're the one that's consuming the service. So another important commercial element to think about is making sure that you have the right to have some audit of what's going on with your counterparty and being able to oversee what they're doing, again, in some manner. You know, Andrew will get a little more into this, but it's a common area that gets negotiated now, because there's a push and pull of, you know, whether a AI tool provider wants to provide lots of information about how its product works, but there's got to be some measure of transparency. Otherwise, you know, a counterparty might not feel that comfortable moving ahead, knowing that, well, there's no way to evidence that these folks are actually, you know, that they have any plan in place to describe how their algorithm works, how they're managing for bias issues, IP issues, other things. But it's something that's really important to, you know, to push on, especially if you're on the customer end. Certainly if you're on the provider side, you know, I think it's fair. You want to provide some information, but again, you can't provide so much that you're giving away valuable assets or trade secrets, things like that. So it's a balance of trying to find enough information that gives you comfort, enough contractual protection to protect from the biggest risks, but not putting a service provider in a position that they feel like they have to provide their secret sauce, so to speak, which gets into more of the sort of the maintenance of these contracts and these relationships. And some measure of testing is a good idea throughout the life of the contract. And it connects to the different issues we're talking about, right? We've talked about the training material aspect, you know, how data is sourced, how the algorithms work. We'll get more into the outputs and the risks related there, but having some standards for, you know, in the contract for, you know, the outputs have to be of this quality or need to achieve certain level of accuracy. How it's very deal specific, but it's reasonable to push for these things. And again, you know, we've talked about bias and other sort of harmful behavior, like if the AI tool hallucinates, which is just when an output is from one of these tools is just completely wrong. It just makes up information. These are things that you can manage and test for throughout the life of the contract. And it's the same type of concept that you'd see in any tech services agreement. These are common concepts that you just want to apply and make specific to the generative AI context. So reliance is another big topic, right? Especially if you're integrating these tools in a way that's very important to your business, you want to understand, okay, what happens if this thing goes wrong? If I need to unplug it, so to speak, how is that going to impact your systems? Are you going to need help from the service provider to disintegrate your, you know, this integrated tool from your system, or can you do it yourself? Do you have a backup plan if it's an essential service? These are things you want to consider internally, and then to the extent you need your counterparty to help implement a backup plan, you want to make sure that's memorialized in the agreement, so that you're not stuck in a situation where your business is going to be negatively impacted and you don't really have a way to sort of mitigate it. So this is a bit of a zoom out on just some common risk areas and concerns, some of which we've talked about, but it's just good to keep these in mind and from the commercial perspective. We've talked again about, you know, bias and you know, transparency and other sort of accountability concepts, which again, it's important to understand that from a diligence perspective up front, and then try and manage it throughout, you know, with contractual terms. And then the generative AI specific risks, again, I mentioned the hallucination, which is basically just when the thing is malfunctioning and creating results that, you know, are non sequitur, incorrect, whatever, however you want to put it. Memorization is another concept to keep in mind. And this is when elements of the training data or the training material get reproduced almost verbatim as an output. And this can happen, and it can create IP issues, certainly could create issues related to privacy if somehow personal information is being reproduced that was used in the training material that shouldn't have showed up in the output, but it does. Deep fakes, I'm sure you've all seen the news that AI's ability to sort of recreate real people's images, voices, all of that. These are more just broad issues to keep in mind, that again, you want to be cognizant of as you are considering moving into the space. Ask the questions and then manage for it in the contract. Here we're talking more about sort of the internal process, right? There's sort of your internal management of how to use generative AI, and then how you're going to deal with it, in partnerships with your customers, your counterparties, whatever whatever it is that you plan to do. But one of the things we really push on with the clients we work with is, it's good to just be organized internally of how you're going to deal with generative AI. How are you going to use it? How are you going to manage use by your employees? Who makes decisions about when you can use a tool? When is something too risky? When is it not? So this, just kind of outlines a very high level structure of, how you can think about that. And Andrew alluded to some of the standards that are emerging, like the NIST standards, for example, in the intro, that can also help organizations figure out a governance process. But the basic idea is, you want to do some diligence on the product you're thinking about using. You want to understand, the decision tree of, who needs to sign off on this? Is there sufficient testing? And then is there sufficient, oversight during the deployment phase? And that, if you keep all those things in mind, you'll be in pretty good shape. It's important to have certain tools in place at the organization, whether it's a governance framework, like a few page document that outlines that you give to your employees and say, look, generative AI, this is what you can and can't do. This is who you need to talk to if you want to use it. It doesn't have to be a long document, something simple that helps people figure out what to do. Because our experience is, a lot of clients are just struggling to keep up with all the requests from different employees, different departments that want to use these tools for generating software code or generating marketing copy or automating this or that process. So having just a general framework that's simple that will funnel the questions to the right people, even that is very helpful in an organization. And there's other tools that can be useful, whether it's, template terms to put in when you're entering into a generative AI agreement, or a checklist of terms to tick off of, when I'm doing one of these deals, I need to think about these 10 or 20 issues. Having those types of tools will help kind of take the mystery out of it and not necessarily fear, but just any, unease around moving into this area. There are ways that you can be organized, and that's kind of what we're talking about when we're thinking about sort of governance within the organization. So this is one where we wanted to drill down on the bias issues. Again, it's one of the bigger risk areas we see, which is why we wanted a specific slide on it and why we mentioned it a few times. These are just some questions you can ask as part of your diligence process, right? To get comfort with the counterparty that they're managing bias issues with their product. And if you or yourselves are trying to launch a product or you're developing something with a third party, then you need to consider these things yourself. So again, important to be locked in on the bias issues and ensure that you're managing for that risk. So just going to spend a couple of slides on IP and then hand it over to Andrew to talk some more about some other contracting issues and diligence issues. But this is a sort of a very basic overview of sort of like an AI tool ecosystem, right? You've got your algorithm, you've got some software code that is going to implement it. And then there's the training material that the algorithm has used to get smarter, and that's the data and the databases. And depending on, again, I mentioned data, in this context, not just facts and information, it could be any type of content. So you want to be cognizant of the different types of IP rights that might be in each of these buckets, and understand if you're using a tool, if you're fine tuning it, if you're doing different things with the inputs, are you going to allow people to use the inputs that you provide as part of further training? You just want to think about the rights of each of these components and make sure it's covered in the agreement. And at the bottom, we've got a variety of causes of action that relate to actually enforcing data rights. Because I mentioned data generally is not protected by IP law, like true facts and information, right? But there are ways to defend against the use of data without permission, like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which, you know, could prevent unauthorized scraping, and contractual breaches like a violation of terms of service. There's other things you can use to protect your data, even if it's not protected by IP. And copyright, of course, has been coming up a lot in the generative AI context, particularly in the content world, sort of use of copyrighted content to train these models. But it's relevant on the output side, and it's relevant on, you know, for people outside of the sort of entertainment realm, for instance, because these tools, again, they can generate research reports, they could generate software code. There's lots of use cases where you want to be thinking about copyright issues as well. So this is just a continuation of what we were just talking about. And when you're entering into these deals, you want to understand, you know, the rights to the algorithms and the models. And again, if let's say you're a customer, you're engaging a third party, if they're going to use your inputs, your prompts as further training, do you care about that? Do you want some right in the improved algorithm? Do you care if the improved algorithm then gets used with one of your competitors, right? Those are the types of questions you want to think about when you're talking about the proprietary rights and usage of information in this ecosystem. And then, of course, it's always important to think about open source usage, right? If you are using open source tools, or a company you're working with is using open source tools, sometimes those open source terms can be very onerous and might have, you know, IP terms that are not desirable, sort of embedded. So you want to understand if open source is part of the mix, review those terms, make sure that everything is fine from a rights perspective, at least from your perspective. So with that, I'm going to just take a minute to talk about outputs on the next slide. And so we're just talking about the things that come out of the tool, right? And thinking about the rights there. So in the U.S. at least, the Copyright Office has said, look, you have to have a human author to get copyright in something. So there's a real question over to what extent outputs are protectable under any regime, right? Copyright's been pretty clear. Similarly on the patent front. So basic question is, if it's important to own the outputs of generative AI, then you might not want to use generative AI to create whatever content. It may not matter, but you just want to understand up front that if it's being used, and understand the risks with that. If that's a concern, you know, you can put reps and warranties in your agreements and say, look, for anything that's delivered to us that we need to own, it has to be human authored, you know, it has to be human created. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Andrew to spend the last few minutes talking about some additional transactional topics, and happy to answer questions later. Thanks.
Thanks, Adrian. So we're going to just take a couple minutes on some contractual things, and then we'll do Q&A. So the first is, I think Adrian made a very good point that when you think about AI, it can appear in various different places in the ecosystem. So for a medical device company, it could be that you are developing a device that will use AI as part of the device's function and operation. Or it could be that you're using AI or you're contracting with a service provider who has a tool that's going to help you develop some software code that's going to be incorporated in your device. So I think it's important to think about that these issues may come up in a bunch of contexts. And then I guess a third context is you might be looking at acquiring a company that has an AI developed or enabled device and or has been developed with AI. And so you'll sort of be diligencing things from like a, an M&A standpoint. And that's probably where I encounter them the most. So some important things to think about in the contract, and Adrian sort of touched on a number of these, is that in the context of diligence, and I always say in any transactional context, you have diligence, then you have contractual terms that are meant to support and confirm your assessments and diligence, and hopefully never need to be relied upon, but maybe give you some rights, you know, after the fact in the event that, you know, a problem arises. So just a couple of these to focus on here. First, you know, sort of audit rights, and I think Adrian made the point that the developer of an AI tool will have a very strong sense of their proprietary rights in their tool, but it's going to be very important for someone who is looking to exploit and receive the outputs of that tool to understand and be able to confirm, for instance, that it's transparent, that it's operating the way it should be, that it's not, you know, the output isn't what Adrian described as hallucinations, that there isn't sort of bias. And so this is an area that can be heavily negotiated. In general, it's, you know, one where you find that because of the very significant value that the developer of the tool sees in their tool, that, you know, you have limited access to rights. But you do sometimes you have things like maybe you don't get to see the, you know, the tool exactly, or maybe you don't get to see the individual data exactly, but some kind of aggregation of the data to try to establish that you don't think there's a presence of bias, or that you can you know, develop some level of comfort to that level. Another point just to talk about here is kind of indemnification. So for those who don't sort of do this all the time, that's like, where does, you know, one party protect the other party from bad things happening? And I hope that if you've, you know, listened so far, you've kind of come away with the fact that there's a fair amount of risk in these tools, because you're sort of using the AI to do what we would normally think of as kind of human thinking. And so there's meant to be some predictability to it, but there's still a fair amount of risk. And so, you know, in the indemnification provisions, there's, again, heavily negotiated back and forth between, say, a vendor of an AI tool or the provider of a service and the recipient as to what level of protection will there be. I mean, to say something like, we'll guarantee the outputs, that the outputs are all good, that would be sort of way beyond, I think, what you observe people willing to do. We're kind of seeing that people recognize that there needs to be, for some of the reasons, you know, Adrian described, he in fact alluded to the getting a rep to this fact, that the recipient of, and you know, the outputs of an AI tool will want some level of comfort that those outputs are themselves, you know, not subject to somebody else's intellectual property. So they have the freedom to operate with them. And so that's a level of indemnity for, you know, and like any third party infringement by the outputs of a tool, if it's used as kind of agreed in the contract. And so that's when you get to things like scope of use and permissions, you know, to sort of really make sure that you stay within the boundaries of where you may have some protection. And then the last thing I'll just, you know, just touch on in the third parties, I mean, like any other area that we see transactionally that involves intellectual property rights and licensing and sharing, sort of ownership and revenue sharing and the economics are often key areas for negotiation. So this is sort of a summary reiteration. I think that we've, you know, touched on most of these. These are important areas for diligence if you are looking to acquire, you know, an AI-enabled product or a product developed through AI. Make sure that you understand how each of these factors flow through. And then just sort of for an illustration, these might be some of the questions that you might ask of a party that has a, you know, has either an AI device or an AI you know, service that they're proposing to, you know, a tool they're proposing to make available. And I think these are good questions to ask about transparency, to really make sure you understand and that they've thought through and have taken appropriate actions that tool will be appropriate for your use. And then last, just to give you a sense, and this is something where I don't know that there's any kind of a standardized form. So as a as a transactional lawyer, there are certain areas of representations and warranties where there's a very clear market for kind of what level of representation, you know, a party in a given type of transaction would be expected to give. I think here in the AI context, this is very much a developing market. But these are some matters that we would think would be very appropriate if you were, for instance, a buyer of a product, by which I mean like the rights to a product, or buyer of a company that had an AI-enabled product. I think these are matters that you would definitely want to, in addition to the due diligence, you would want to get your arms around from a rep and warranty standpoint. And there could be disclosures against these, but I think these would at least help you support your diligence and hopefully, you know, help you assess from a real kind of in writing rep and warranty standpoint.
Maybe we should just
Actually it. Yeah, I think we're ready to go.
Right. Yeah. So we do have just a few questions that have come in. So one question asks about how are AI devices certified by FDA? Please give an example of a specific AI device that has been approved by the FDA and is available on the market. I think the best answer there is to actually take a look at FDA's website. So what I'm talking about here, and I'm happy to interact specifically with this person who posed the question, but FDA's website has a portion on it that's called Artificial Intelligence and Machine Learning Enabled Medical Devices, which actually has a list of all of the devices that have been cleared or approved for marketing that are AI enabled that was updated on October 19th. And it's up to 171 devices. So I think that will make this much more concrete, and I'm happy to give a specific site to that, but it's pretty easy. I went onto the website and FDA's website and just put in AI enabled medical device and it came right up. So I think that's where to look for that. So there's a question about whether there are similar questions to payers and bias transparency. Has this also been a focus in Washington? I haven't, again, I'm more in the FDA space than on the payer side. So I think I'd like to kind of reserve on that. At the very least, I would think that is encompassed at a high level by the executive order that was just issued. But I would be happy to get a more specific answer on that. I'm not aware of an issuance, a document, a think paper on that at this point, but happy to follow up with that questioner, and our email should be available through Medical Alley. So I think that would make the most sense. And then I know we did have a question that came in before around liability and negligence. I don't know, Andrew, if you want to just speak to that at a very high level. I'll caveat by saying that you have before you an FDA regulatory privacy and a transactional lawyer, and not a product liability or medical malpractice lawyer. So we received a question ahead of the webinar and quickly conferred with our product liability colleagues so we could at least give a little bit of direction on that question. But maybe, Andrew, you could tee that one up.
Sure. So the question was, you know, please discuss whether and how errors by an AI medical device or errors in its use could create any unique claims for malpractice or negligence on the part of a healthcare provider or the manufacturer. And based on, you know, a very quick discussion with some of our colleagues who focus on product liability, I mean, my take would be that I don't think there's anything necessarily specific about AI that would be different than kind of what you might expect generally when thinking about product liability for defective medical devices. So first, for an HCP, I think use of the device, I think they would say that use of the device in accordance with, you know, its label and indications and instructions should not give rise to liability for malpractice or negligence for the healthcare provider. And then in terms of the manufacturer, you know, they're all, a lot of the things we talked about design, I think there's going, you know, whether the manufacturer has, you know, introduced a defect by, you know, not having, you know, been appropriate in its implementation of the various testing best practices and things like that we discussed. I think that could clearly I could see how that could become, you know, a question of fact of whether there's a defect. One thing they did note is that, you know, for if a device is a PMA device, could be subject to federal preemption. So that's something to think about. But again, that's like a basic traditional product liability, you know, point for medical devices. So I think that's kind of very quick, not non-expert thoughts on that question.
Well, there's one final question. Is there a list of the bias that are concerns in AI? I'm not aware of a specific list. I mean, the things obviously that come up in the FDA regulated world are whether a data set, for example, is biased in terms of gender or an ethnicity such that the device is trained in a way that it's not broadly usable in a safe and effective manner for the intended population. But again, if we're happy to kind of drill down more on that question on an individual basis to really get at the heart of it. But in terms of a sort of widely published list, that's not something that we're aware of. We certainly want to express our gratitude to the audience and to Medical Alley for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. And we'd be delighted to interact with you individually if additional questions come up or follow-ups on the questions that were posed in the course of the webinar. Thanks very much.
We appreciate that, Pam. Thank you. Thank you to everyone from the Covington team, Pam, Andrew, and Adrian. This is such an important, pertinent topic. We know these discussions will continue. So thank you again for your time and your expertise here today. Thank you to everybody in the audience who has registered for today's event. Again, it is recorded. So if you'd like to go back and watch part of the presentation again, that is available. One last thing before we wrap up here today, too. If you enjoyed today's webinar, make sure you're subscribed to the Medical Alley newsletter. It's the best place where you'll be able to find more great content like this and some other events like this down the road. So with that, it's 11 o'clock. Thank you all for being with us here and have a wonderful rest of your day.